This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome. This week we have a show packed with good news, horrible news, and crazy news all about the coming climate shift. Yes, those greeny extremists say we have only 5 fossil fuel polluting years left before planet Earth is thrown on an unstoppable path towards extreme climate change. Oh, wait. This warning comes from the conservative voice of 28 major countries, the International Energy Agency. It's the most depressing news yet. Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute has at least a dribble of good stuff. U.S. greenhouse gas emissions are starting to drop. And it's not just because Americans are broke with no manufacturing left. Just before we all pop a handful of antidepressants in this madness, we take off for the UK to learn how to protest for sanity. We speak to Emily James, executive producer of The Age of Stupid. Her new film, Just Do It, follows the climate camps, which foreshadowed the whole Occupy movement, and the young activists who won't take climate wrecking lying down. Just Do It is a tool for activist training. You could use it. It's already being shown in Occupy camps around the world.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage.
It's way too much. Too much for one show, but let's give it a shot.
Pushing through the market square. So many mothers sighing. News had just come over. We had 5 years left crying. News guy wept and told us Earth was really dying. Cried so much his face was wet. Then I knew was not lying. I heard telephones, opera house, favorite melodies.
When David Bowie released those words in 1972, the nuclear madness was ripe but didn't blow us all up. Now the big International Energy Agency, the IEA, which hasn't given a hoot about climate change for decades, suddenly issues a stark warning. As the Guardian newspaper headline says, if fossil fuel infrastructure is not rapidly changed, the world will lose forever the chance to avoid dangerous climate change, end quote. The door is closing, says IEA chief economist Fatih Birol, and if we can't change our energy infrastructure in the next 5 years, quote, the door will be closed forever. If we add up all those fossil fuels we could still burn and stay below the 450 parts per million thought to keep us below 2 degrees of global warming, and that might keep the Greenland ice sheet, we only have a little of that burning capacity left. In fact, the IEA study calculates we will have burned at least 90% of that last reserve by 2015. By 2017, if we want a habitable climate for our descendants, we have to stop burning all fossil fuels and prevent other human-made greenhouse gases from entering the atmosphere. In 2010, we tossed a record 30.6 gigatons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, about 6% more than the year before. Quoting from the report, the International Energy Agency says, on planned policies, rising fossil energy use will lead to irreversible and potentially catastrophic climate change. We are on an even more dangerous track to an increase of 6 degrees centigrade or 11 degrees Fahrenheit. Delaying action is a false economy. For every $1 of investment in cleaner technology that is avoided in the power sector before 2020, an additional $4.30 would need to be spent after 2020 to compensate for the increased emissions, end quote from the IEA. Well, a global average warming of 6 degrees centigrade or 11 degrees Fahrenheit is the disaster that British scientist Sir James Lovelock warned us about years ago. Scientists calculate that around 11 or 12 degrees Fahrenheit extra heating, mammals can no longer cool themselves with sweat, and that means goodbye. And these are global average increases. Some places like the Arctic may go up 25 degrees or more to become tropical rainforests. Most of Africa, the United States, and large parts of Asia would become uninhabitable. And we haven't even talked about the total disruption of rainfall patterns like droughts and floods and fires on land. or the stratification of the ocean, which can lead to a shift in species, leading to dead zones or even dead seas? Here is what expert blogger Joe Rome wrote at thinkprogress.org. Quote, "The IEA report deserves the label bombshell because for most of the past two decades, the IEA was the source of bland, conservative, business-as-usual analysis. When I was acting Assistant Secretary of Energy for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy in 1997, no one at DOE paid much attention to IEA reports, and that perspective continued through most of the 2000s. But in just the last few years, they have woken up to the risks posed to peak oil. See the IEA top economist warns in August of 2009, quote, we have to leave oil before oil leaves us, end quote, and especially to climate change. Now the IEA has done the calculation in a different way, concluding, quote, delaying action is a false economy. Those who counsel waiting for breakthrough technologies, Joe Rome says, are urging us on a path that is unsustainable, irreversible, potentially catastrophic, and economically indefensible. And that is according to the IEA. The new analysis shows that because of the soaring emissions, we are running out of time for the 450 scenario. We are at risk of irreversibly locking in dangerous warming. Thank you. That ends my quote from Joe Rome. And thank you, Joe, for leading us through the latest climate news. As I told EcoShock listeners previously, climate scientists are still figuring out why we haven't already heated even more, according to the emissions we release. Sure, we've seen record floods, fires, storms, tornadoes, and the Russian heat wave of 2010, but it could be hotter already. The always worthwhile podcast called The Climate Show from New Zealand offers a good summary of current thought. There are three known cooling factors operating. One, aerosols from a wave of new Asian coal plants pump sulfates into the atmosphere, which reflects sunlight back into space. That's a limited-time offer. Second, the sun has been in a quiet period with few sunspots and solar flares. That may be ending, as NASA reported a monster solar flare on November 4th. That particular flare was not facing the Earth, so we did not get hit, but it may indicate the period of solar quiet is over, which could add slightly to our warming. Third, and the largest factor, is ocean mixing. The ocean absorbs somewhere between 80 and 90% of all the excess energy in a greenhouse atmosphere. The seas mix this down. Recent research shows even the very deepest parts of the ocean are warming slightly. All this heat will come back out eventually, guaranteeing warming for centuries, if not millennia. In the last 2 years, the cooler waters are coming up in the phenomenon known as La Niña. Another recent study has shown the ocean cycle called ENSO has not been affected by climate change. So the warmer water phenomenon called El Niño, which gave us the record hot year of 1998, should return in the next year or two. When it does, expect record heat waves. Even with all those cooling factors, NASA still named 2010 as the hottest year on record. It is frightening to imagine the coming climate disasters as we ramp up. And according to the IEA and a series of national academies around the world, we have just 5 years to drastically cut all our greenhouse gas emissions. Meanwhile, all countries and all players like the U.S., Canada, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Japan intend to do nothing at the next climate change conference in Durban at the end of November 2011. The American Congress continues to deny global warming is even happening. Presidential candidates promise they will get rid of any environmental laws and the Environmental Protection Agency. Our future is not looking good. At times, I fear the remainder of humanity will end up in northern Canada, Scandinavia, Siberia, Patagonia, New Zealand, and Tasmania. The rest of the world could be wrecked and uninhabitable. To fend off this ultimate pessimism, I can only offer two bits of good news. First, we'll look at a few patterns in the original big polluter, the United States, where greenhouse gas emissions are going down, no matter what the politicians do or say. Lester Brown explains that. And don't forget, we're going to wrap up with a tasty interview and new film on how to get out there and make some noise before we all go down in flames. But first, an interview on the cutting edge, synthetic biology, capturing climate genes, and fending off crazy last-ditch ideas to shade off the sun. Check this out. Right now, global corporations and scientists are plotting a coup against the natural order of things. They want to control the weather, the sky, the food you eat, maybe even the design of your body someday. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Diana Bronson is the program manager for an international organization called the Etc. Group, with offices in Canada, the U.S., Mexico, and the Philippines. Their latest book is Earth Grab, Geopiracy, the New Biomasters, and Capturing Climate Genes. Haven't heard about that? We'll also talk about synthetic biology, geoengineering, and other risky projects your mother never told you about. Diana Bronson, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's my pleasure.
We've already mentioned a shopping list of new trends flying under the public radar. Let's work our way down the list, maybe starting with capturing climate genes. What is that about?
Well, this is really trying to manufacture plants and crops that will withstand the stresses of climate change so that, for example, they're drought resistant or saline resistant or can withstand extreme temperatures. And, of course, plants can slowly evolve and adapt to climate change to a certain degree. But what we're talking about here is really technological interventions that are largely sponsored by the largest agricultural, food, and forestry firms in the world. What we discovered in this report, which is the third of the three that are published in the book Earth Grab by Pambazuka Press, is that a handful of multinational corporations have patented a whole series of multigenome sequences that essentially amounts to taking proprietary control over those sequences in order to be able to manipulate them and then sell them back to farmers at a profit. So we found there's 262 patent families, they're called. Those are patents of the same nature, but there's 262 different ones that were claimed by six multinational corporations and their smaller partners between 2008 and 2010. What we're saying that shows is that the capacity to adapt to climate change is no longer going to be left in the hands of governments and the representatives of people and local communities who are going to need to develop new ways of farming and develop new traits within plants. It'll in fact be owned by multinational corporations like Monsanto and Bayer and BASF and Syngenta. And so that's really a very worrying tendency, and we don't see why, if climate change is the emergency that the entire world seems to agree that it is, why we would allow private corporations to control such technologies.
So if we had horrible climate change, we'd have to buy our new agricultural plants from them.
Well, there'll be a big push to do that. You know, there's a number of very influential organizations and corporations and northern governments and private foundations who are saying that we've got to up food production to meet the growing population, expected to be 9 billion people by 2050. We've got to intensify agricultural production and so on, and that we're going to need these technologies and these corporations to do that. We actually think it's quite the contrary that needs to be done. We need to put food production back into the hands of small-scale farmers and create policy environments that is favorable to them. And that'll not only improve food security, but it will improve climate resilience. We explain that in quite some detail in a report called Who Will Feed Us that you can get on etcetera.group.org's website. That's not in the Earth Grab book, although many of the statistics and the analysis is present in the report called Capturing Climate Genes.
So your book, Earth Grab, also has a report on the new biomasters, and the emphasis here is on biomass. What is going on that we need to be concerned about?
Yeah, it's a little bit like the story around biofuels gone wild. I mean, what happened when Western governments started to massively subsidize biofuels, subsidies that are still going on to this day, is that it threw the world into an even worse food crisis than it already was. As you may or may not know, or as listeners may or may not know, about 1 billion people in the world today don't have enough to eat. And even the initial steps of corn ethanol threw an estimated 170 million people into hunger. And the problem is, in a broad general sense, is that we're imagining all kinds of new uses for biomass, which is just a name for undifferentiated living stuff, you know, rather than having plants and trees and growth and all of these different types of biodiverse living organisms. It's all just lumped together as biomass and commodified as such. There's a whole series of uses that are being imagined for this. It's going to provide fuel, it's going to provide food, it's going to provide energy, all of these things. And basically the problem is that 80% of the world's biomass is located in the tropical and subtropical regions. Where it has not been commodified, people are living on it. And for the most part, those people are living fairly sustainable lives compared to the kind of lives that we live in the north. And when we contemplate all these new uses for this biomass, corporations get very interested, wealthy governments get very interested, and land begins to get bought up. And that has become a fairly well-known phenomenon called the land grab, which the non-governmental organization GRAIN did a great deal to expose back in 2008. And as increasingly alternatives are sought to the fossil fuel economy, rather than looking at small-scale, local, adaptable solutions for renewable energy, we're looking for the next big thing. And there you will find also that it's the very same oil and chemical companies who have been involved in the fossil fuel industry who are actually involved in the new biomass economy. So, you know, BP, for instance, is there, and they're all partnering with these smaller firms, many of whom are involved in a technology called synthetic biology. And perhaps just to say a few words about what synthetic biology is, it's a form of extreme genetic engineering. Well, as traditionally GM crops, what they do is they take a gene sequence from one crop and they put it into another crop in order to develop a certain trait. Well, synthetic biology actually attempts to build living materials from scratch and create entirely synthetic organisms that have no natural equivalent. So when you start looking at these technologies and the impacts that they could have, it can become very serious indeed. For example, let's talk about algae. Very often you'll read in the newspaper that, you know, algae is going to be the next clean fuel. Well, we need to think about, well, where is that algae going to be grown? And it's true that algae does suck down carbon dioxide. It consumes carbon dioxide. That's how it grows. But are we going to have synthetic algae grown in open ponds that can then be released into the broader environment and sort of act like an invasive species does when a species from one part of the world is artificially transported to another? And how will that affect natural ecosystems? And will it even work? You know, that's another whole question. We know, for example, in the case of corn ethanol, that when you do a full life cycle analysis of that biofuel, the greenhouse gas emissions are just as high as fossil fuels because of the energy that went into the inputs and the transportation and so on, not to mention the way it threatens food security. You know, what we're saying about biomass is let's just be very, very cautious about lumping things together as biomass and assuming there's endless amounts of it that can be appropriated and generated into various products from plastic to fuel to all these other things that will allow us to keep on living the lifestyles that we live.
I've got to tell you, you're giving me the shivers here. We're going to take everything that grows, everything that's green, and we're going to grind it up in the machine to get stuff out for ourselves. And then maybe we'll release some sort of new goo that could take over the oceans. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our last short interview with Pat Mooney of the Etc. Group was in 2007. That story, called Don't Geoengineer the Oceans, has been downloaded over 10,000 times from our website. There's lots of interest. Diana, maybe you could begin by defining geoengineering.
Yeah, geoengineering is the large-scale technological manipulation of the Earth's systems, and usually these days it's discussed in reference to climate change as a so-called solution to climate change.
And what are some of the new technologies being suggested to cool off an overheated planet?
Well, for example, the sort of top technology that's being discussed in scientific and policy circles, mostly in the UK and the United States, but also in Canada and Germany and Australia and other countries is known as stratospheric aerosols. And the idea there is that you're going to pump small particles of sulfur dioxide or possibly of other chemicals into the upper layer of the Earth's atmosphere, the stratosphere, about 25 kilometers off the surface of the Earth, in order to reflect a portion of the sunlight back to outer space. They call this solar radiation management. Another technology, as you referred to earlier, is ocean fertilization. That would be dumping iron particles or nitrogen into the ocean in order to provoke the growth of algae once again to suck up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and then sink it to the bottom of the ocean. This is very much discredited in scientific circles, but nonetheless, there's corporations and some scientists who continue to want to explore this idea as a solution to global warming. You can get a much better idea of all the technologies. There's about 30 of them, I would say, depending on how you classify them, in the overview that's provided in EarthGrab or off our website from Geopiracy, the case against geoengineering. There's a full listing and a critique of some of them and a more detailed critique of some of them, as well as an analysis of who is behind these technologies, particularly from the scientific milieu, but also from governments and corporations. I'd say that corporations aren't yet into geoengineering in a big way. It's still too high risk for them, and it would do a great deal of damage if they were out front on this issue. But nevertheless, for example, Bill Gates has been investing in this area. He's got major investments into a carbon dioxide removal technology that's being developed by David Keith in Calgary. Richard Branson has been involved with his carbon war room. So, you know, there are well-known industrialists who are involved. But for the most part, it's been a kind of scientific lobby along with some very strong supporters within the UK and US governments.
Well, now, Diana, as you know, greenhouse gas emissions just hit another record in 2010. There's no end in sight. Some scientists and governments say we need to have geoengineering in our toolbox in case there's a sudden and abrupt climate change. Maybe we'll thank them then. How do you reply to that argument?
Well, there's several things. I think the risks are far greater in deploying these technologies. For example, if you talk about stratospheric aerosols, assuming that it would actually work, which is a large assumption, a very generous assumption, once you started doing it, you could never stop. And then the other thing is that this reduces the willingness of governments to invest in mitigation. Already we're dealing with very, very low levels of political will, and we need to turn that around. And I don't think the way to turn that around is to say, we've got a technological fix, that if we throw, you know, a few billion dollars at research, you know, it may work one day. Well, what if it doesn't? I mean, ultimately, there's no long-term solution for the problem of climate change that does not involve changing the ways in which we live. So it's rather hubristic, to say the least, that we'd put all our money in that technology, speculative technology basket, rather than doing things like invest in public transportation, develop agroecological farming systems that would reduce the ecological footprint of industrial farming, that would better feed the world as well. There's so many other solutions that we can provide for global warming that do not involve this level of risk. And then the other thing about it is it's incredibly inequitable in terms of a north-south dynamic. The northern governments that are involved and the northern scientists that are involved and who are dominating this discussion, you know, talk about, oh, well, perhaps the G8 or perhaps the G20 or perhaps a coalition of the willing or perhaps a small coalition of countries with scientific capabilities will get together, will write the rules. And what we've been saying is that that's completely unacceptable. There's no way this should go ahead. It needs to be discussed at the United Nations. Then every country has something to say about that. And I think, you know, last year at the Convention on Biological Diversity, we won a moratorium on these technologies. That's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it just put a little bit the brakes on. We need to strengthen that moratorium. We need to change it into a firm ban on any kind of experimentation of geoengineering technologies that do not have international consent and authority. There's no way that one country or a small group of countries or even one scientist or one corporation should be allowed to you know, undertake the manipulation of the climate on behalf of the rest of us. And right now, it's a bit of a free-for-all.
Right, that's such a scary prospect. It could be a billionaire or just a country like Russia or any country could say, well, you know, it's too hot for us, so we're going to send this stuff up into the stratosphere and block off the sunlight for everybody. And I wonder what happens if you block incoming sunlight, what happens to agricultural production and the wild plants and the animals?
Yeah, and the precipitation patterns and solar power. And in fact, you know, you stop having blue skies. There's a great article that was written about this by Alan Robach called 20 Reasons Why Geoengineering May Be a Bad Idea. And if you go to his website, you'll be able to see a couple of updates on the article. But there's many, many reasons why this kind of geoengineering is a bad idea. It's also, you know, basically it's been an accepted principle of international law that we employ the precautionary principle on these kinds of things. And when there's such uncertainty on what the impacts could be, we should not be going ahead.
Okay, well, there is pushback from civil organizations, including your own Etc. group. Who are some of the key voices and institutions we should be searching out in defense of the natural world?
Well, there's many. I mean, one thing that people can do is go to a campaign website. It's called handsoffmotherearth.org. And you can actually send in your photo and signify your opposition to these kinds of technologies there. Of course, there's many, many organizations, environmental and social organizations, and you'll see many of them, in fact, on that website who've signed up to that website, who we work, such as Friends of the Earth, Third World Network, La Via Campesina, and many, many more who have been active on this issue. So that's probably a good place to start, and then you could go and visit any of the other organizations that are listed there. Of course, organizations like Greenpeace are also following this. It's just really important that we look at both the environmental and social impacts of these technologies. And right now, internationally, we have no mechanism for doing that. It's very interesting. You know, we're headed into the Rio Plus 20 conference. It's the 20th anniversary of the Earth Summit that took place in Brazil in 1992. And one of the things that was agreed to 20 years ago was the world needed some means to assess technologies before they were deployed around the globe. That's in Chapter 34 of Agenda 21, if anybody cares to look it up. But that was never done. So we've also got a major push on to try and get technology assessment incorporated into the Rio Plus 20 process that'll take place next June. And the negotiations for that are ongoing. The first draft of that statement is expected in January. And we're pushing very hard with many, many other organizations to have some kind of technology assessment adopted.
Well, tell us how we can find the Etc. Group and your new book, Earth Grab.
Okay, well, Etc. Group, you can find us online at etcgroup.org. You can find many, many reports on our website, including those that are in Earth Grab. In fact, Earth Grab has the most updated versions of those reports, and you can get it from Pambazuka Press. Pambazuka Press is an African publisher, and they've undertaken to publish these reports because they think that what we have to say, I guess, is highly relevant for Africa. And you can buy a copy of Earth Grab on their website, Pambazuka. I think it's pambazuka.org. Earth Grab, published by Pambazuka Press.
I'll put a link in my blog at ecoshock.info. People can find it. As we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I just, once again, really encourage people to get involved and get informed and pressure their governments and write about it in their media and find out more about it by getting more information and perhaps sending in their photo to signify their opposition to these technologies at handsoffmotherearth.org.
You have been listening to Diana Bronson from the Etc. Group. We've been talking about new and dangerous developments at the fringe of industrialized science. Find out more at www.etcgroup.org. Thank you, Diana.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I promised you a bit of good news. Yes, I know it goes against Radio EcoShock show policy, but I trust this source. Lester Brown founded the World Watch Institute and then his own Earth Policy Institute. He's a man for numbers and facts, and he's trusted by Greens, industry, and governments. That's a rare combination these days. Here are selections from a Lester Brown press teleconference November 2nd. You also hear Lester's response to a couple of doubts I raised on your behalf.
And now I'll turn over the call to Lester Brown, who is an author and current president of the Earth Policy Institute. His latest book, World on the Edge, provides a roadmap for how to prevent an environmental and economic collapse. And that book is also available on the EPI website. And I'll turn the call over to Lester.
Thank you, Jen. In thinking about the trend that we're looking at this morning, this reversal in carbon emissions, I've tried to think of a word to describe it, and historic is the only one that I can think of. After decades, generations actually, of rising carbon emissions, suddenly we're headed down, and it's not just a short-term blip. Between 2007 and 2011, U.S. coal use dropped by 10%. Oil use went down by 11%. Natural gas is up by 6%. The net effect of these trends is that U.S. carbon emissions have dropped 7% in the last 4 years. We are using data for 2011 that are based on, that are actually Department of Energy estimates. They used the actual data for the first 8 months of this year and then made estimates for the four concluding months to come up with the estimates for 2011. It's been widely assumed that the decline in carbon emissions is the result of the economic downturn. And that was initially the case, but now there are new forces at work that are driving this decline in carbon emissions, forces that are surprisingly strong and that will be continuing for some time. With coal, we have a strong, well-organized anti-coal movement that's beginning to measurably reduce coal use in this country. In the early stages, it's centered on opposing new coal plants. And as a result of that, there are now very few plants under construction in this country. And we have, in effect, a de facto moratorium on launching new coal plants. The Beyond Coal campaign, as it's called, is coordinated at the national level by the Sierra Club, but it involves a couple of dozen national environmental and health groups, along with hundreds of local groups. It's a well-organized, very strong campaign. The second phase of the campaign is to close existing coal plants. Of the 492 coal plants we have in the United States, 68 are now scheduled to close within the next few years. One of the closings is the Potomac River coal plant, which is just across the river, literally from Washington, D.C. It is scheduled to close by next October 1st. It's a 62-year-old plant. It's a 485-megawatt plant, which means it's a large coal plant, and it burns 280,000 tons of coal every year. So as a source of air pollution, it's a major one, but it will soon be gone, and we'll have some of the cleanest air in D.C. that we've had in generations. The goal of the Beyond Coal movement is to eventually close all the country's coal plants. And there are a number of reasons for that, environmental as well as health. Most people are not aware of it, but burning coal leads to 13,200 deaths each year. That 13,200 deaths exceeds all the U.S. combat fatalities in Afghanistan and Iran over the last 10 years. So it's not inconsequential. The healthcare costs of treating respiratory illnesses is huge. In August, the American Economic Review published the most comprehensive analysis yet of the indirect effects of burning coal in the United States. And their conclusion was a surprising one and a strong one. It basically writes the epitaph for the coal industry. It said that the damage, mostly from air pollution from burning coal, exceeds the value of the electricity produced at coal-fired power plants. So this is not the cost of production. This is the indirect cost, the effect of air pollution on people, crops, etc. The indirect costs are a major factor in the future. This is one of the reasons why New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg donated $50 million to the Sierra Club for their Beyond Coal campaign to further expand it and strengthen it. Michael Bloomberg says, very simply, coal has to go. And he's not talking about closing a few plants. He's talking about closing all the coal plants in the country. In looking ahead, we're seeing, in addition to the 7% drop in carbon emissions over the last 4 years, we think that 7% could increase to 20% by 2020. That is, between 2007, when oil consumption peaked in the U.S., and 2020, we could see a 20% drop in oil use and carbon emissions from oil use. It could go even higher. I mean, conceivably, it could go as high as 30%. But the exciting thing is that carbon emissions, which were rising in the United States, the world's largest economy, are now declining and declining at a rapid, unanticipated rate, I should say. This means that the U.S. could, if this trend continues as we expect it to, could become something of a model for other countries. And it also means that the United States could again emerge as a leader in the effort to stabilize the Earth's climate.
And moving on to Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock.
Lester, I'm wondering how much of the coal figures that you presented, actually the oil figures you presented, the reduction, are the result of two factors offshoring them, one being the offshoring of production to China. Their emissions are rising, and it's partly because everything is made there. And secondly, also, do these figures take into account the excess pollution from the Canadian tar sands, which even without this pipeline are powering a large part of the Midwest? So there's so much emissions in Canada that may not be showing up in the American figures.
Alex, those are both good points. Because we import so many manufactured goods from China, the carbon emissions that are associated with our consumption actually show up in China's carbon emission. That's not a debatable point. And it's true that the numbers I'm talking about do not include those. And it's also the case that the emissions associated with the Canadian tar sands in getting the oil out of the sand show up in Canada's carbon emissions and not ours. So those are two things that would, if we had an accounting system that was based on consumption rather than the production side, we would see a somewhat different world, and China's carbon emissions would not be nearly as large as they are in other countries that, such as the U.S., would be higher than they are. But even given that, the trend of the last 4 years and the trend that we see for the next several years are based on a constant in terms of our relationship with China and with Canada.
Find the whole Lester Brown teleconference on our website at ecoshock.org. Look on the climate change page. Yes, it's good news that U.S. greenhouse gas emissions have gone down, but it's kind of like saying 6% fewer women were raped this year. Not really all that much to cheer about as more gigatons of emissions continue to pour out of American smokestacks and tailpipes. We also have to remember that North Americans are responsible for about half of all the greenhouse gases already in the sky. We never want to admit that. It's like this famous scene from the TV program Seinfeld.
It's insane.
But you did actually throw his coat out the window.
But he doesn't know that. As far as he knows, someone stole it. And that's the person who should be held responsible.
But that's you.
So I guess I'll have to buy him a new coat, even though I don't think I should be held responsible, which I am anyway.
We don't see why we should be held responsible, even though we are. That's what the rest of the developing countries are complaining about. That is why they want the Climate Compensation Fund promised to them by Hillary Clinton and expect to get it at the upcoming Durban Climate Conference. It won't happen, even though it should. Maybe we can make something happen. Maybe we can still force our fossil leaders to try to save the climate for coming generations. Here is news about a film for and about climate activism. A quick trip through YouTube or the international press shows a really creative wave of public protest in England and Scotland. How do they do it? You can find out with the new behind-the-scenes film called Just Do It. The filmmaker was trained at Britain's National Film and Television School. She was executive producer of the well-known climate change picture, The Age of Stupid. Radio EcoShock welcomes Emily James. Hello, Emily.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, since I've not yet seen Just Do It, nobody has, I expect, beyond the trailer on the net, please tell us what we can expect.
Right, so the film covers a year in the life of a community of diverse activists drawn from Climate Camp and Plain Stupid, which are, if you're not familiar with them, two quite large direct action groups in the UK. Climate Camp holds large-scale camps using tents in public spaces to kind of hold autonomous spaces. And Plain Stupid did a number of actions such as shutting down Stansted Airport and getting on top of doing a banner drop from the roof of Parliament, both of which have been sort of quite well known internationally. So I followed them for a year in the run-up to Copenhagen Conference and then for a little while after that, which was a very active year for them. And the film has now been put together into a feature documentary, which will be coming out in America, we hope, early next year.
How did you get the confidence of these young activists to be invited in at the planning stages before the big day?
Well, that was indeed probably one of the biggest challenges of the entire project. When I first started approaching people in Plain Stupid and Climate Camp, they were incredibly hesitant. I mean, Plain Stupid said outright no for 6 months, that they just couldn't participate. And the reason for that was quite obvious, because what I was asking was, can I amass a whole body of material that could potentially be used against you in court to prove a giant conspiracy case? And so, you know, understandably, they were very hesitant. I went away and did a lot of homework. I was lucky enough to get a huge amount of pro bono advice from a legal firm that works with direct action activists representing them. They were, through the advice that I got from them, I was then able to kind of piece together what I called my security protocol. And this ranged from promising the activists that none of the footage would come out before all of their court cases were finished, which I achieved by keeping everything in a safe house, not connected to me or any of them. Because one of the key things that I learned was, if the authorities couldn't get their hands on the material, it would be very hard for them to use it in the system. And the other way that I kept people safe was by not keeping any written records of what I was filming or logs of the tapes, because that would have made a very easy subpoena for the authorities if they had come across that. Every time I went out on an action filming with them, I'd have to completely clear my house and office of anything that had to do with the film, because if I were arrested alongside them, the authorities could get a warrant to search my premises quite easily. So there's quite a lot of safety and security that I put in place. But then I think beyond that, it was an extensive process of getting to know people and gaining their trust. So it wasn't about convincing people to participate. It was about building real relationships with them so that they then wanted to be involved.
Tell us about filming at the Climate Camp, keeping in mind many of our North American listeners have never heard of a climate camp.
Exactly. So, I mean, climate camps, they've done five of them, big, large scales and some small ones. But the big ones, they construct very large, you know, almost like a festival or something, these very large camps using big tents and small tents, and everything's very sustainable on site. So it's all vegan food in the kitchens, it's grey water recycling, it's compost toilets and all of that. But the tricky thing about it is that they put these camps up without permission in spaces where they are not allowed to do so. So there's frequently, shall we say, some disagreements with the authorities about whether they should have these camps in place. And some of the camps have experienced quite an extreme level of policing, with people being stopped and searched as they were coming and going, with multiple arrests, with physical attempts to remove the camps and that sort of thing. So that was quite tricky from that side of things. And on the other side, because of the nature, the camps are training camps for direct action. You know, this is basically people go there, they meet other people, they come up with plans, and then they use that camp as a launching pad to go and launch actions, whether it be depending on which camp it is. There was a camp that was right next to Heathrow Airport. There was another camp that was right next to a large coal-fired power station. So, you know, because people are planning direct action in these camps, they're not very keen to have cameras wandering about just filming whatever they like. So there was a huge amount of negotiation between the campers and people like myself and people who were involved in documenting the camp. But in the end, I think we managed to capture the essence of what they were doing.
That almost sounds like the origins of the Occupy movement. You know, Emily, it seems sometimes like the greatest days of activist stunts and banner hangings are almost over in North America, and I'm not sure why. The corporate media is less cooperative. The terrorist scare after 9/11 made many people duck their heads. But the UK has both those problems and still persists in public actions. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that your nod to the Occupy movement at the beginning of the question is very key, because I think there we see things beginning to change in America around this, you know, people's willingness to engage in this kind of activity. But you're right, during the last sort of 5 to 6 years post 9/11, a lot of this is, you know, there was a groundswell that was moving before that that really has gone quiet. And we've suffered from similar things here in the UK. I mean, the counterterrorism legislation that was passed in this country has been used against everything from students protesting in the street to Plain Stupid to Climate Camp. And in fact, it's the same branch of the police that polices direct action activists as polices domestic terrorists. So this has been a major issue. And in fact, there has recently last year come out a number of stories about undercover police who the authorities had put in place for years on end. So these are deep cover police. So, you know, this is a huge amount of public expense which is being put out to police people who ultimately are just trying to get people to address climate change and other environmental issues, and there's been a massive outcry against that.
So do you see your new film, Just Do It, as kind of a seed that will pass on some of the techniques and problems of that kind of activism?
Well, I suppose I hope so. I did this film because I could see that the story of this moment in time of direct action against climate change, groups like Climate Camp and Plain Stupid, that their story just really wasn't being captured and wasn't going to be told. So it was, as a filmmaker, I found myself in a position where I thought I could make it happen, and it just seemed like I had a responsibility to capture their story, you know, for posterity and to give them their place in history, I think. But I think that what I've seen since the film has started coming out here in the UK is that it is indeed having effects similar to what you describe. I mean, both, I met somebody recently who had seen it when it came out in the cinemas in July, and she told me that since then she had gotten heavily involved with an anti-fracking group here in the UK called Frack Off, and that she had been arrested for the first time as well on one of their actions, and she had never done anything like that before she saw the film. So it clearly had that effect for her, and I'm pleased about that, because I think that what they're doing is a valuable contribution, and a lot of the reason why I wanted to make the film was really to counteract the way that these people were being portrayed in the media, you know, in the news media. There was this paper-thin narrative of them just sort of, you know, being a bunch of hippies and or layabouts or, you know, and it was just a kind of, they were being vilified. And I thought, well, all I've really got to do is show what they're really like to people, and a lot of that will be undone. And that's been, you know, really the case as well. We've had an amazing response here. So, yes, I hope as the film goes out into the rest of the world now, we'll begin to see all kinds of stories coming back to us about how it inspires different people to do different things.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Emily James, a filmmaker with a new piece about activism. Emily, I also wonder whether student debt holds a lot of people back. People think they have to have a squeaky clean record to get the corporate jobs to pay it all back, and of course millions of them never get work in that field anyway. What's the situation in the UK, and how does that relate to protest?
Well, yes, I think you're right about the way that student debt has affected people in North America Absolutely. And unfortunately, we're on the road taking us to a similar direction, because this country has agreed, as you know, one of its many austerity measures that have come in place in the last year, to significantly raise the tuition fees for universities. So we, you know, universities in this country are, although relatively autonomous, they're also sort of state controlled. So it's not quite the same as in America, where you have these astronomical university fees at some places and smaller ones elsewhere. They're relatively similar across the board, and they've now gone from £3,000 to £9,000 a year overnight. So there's a lot of young people in this country who are just automatically not going to have access to university education anymore. But of course, it also will have the other effect of those people who do manage to go to university will be leaving there with a debt that leaves them very little options about what kind of life they can lead after that.
Tell us more about protesting the banks that is now so popular with the Occupy movement.
Well, it's interesting because Climate Camp always had one of its key tenets was a kind of strong statement about the relationship between climate change and capitalism, in as much so as what they would say is that capitalism is a root cause of climate change, and that you can't address climate change without addressing capitalism. And I can remember conversations a few years ago within Climate Camp media meetings and things like that, where they would feel that they had to be quite shy about their anti-capitalism sometimes, you know. It wasn't something that played particularly well to a wide audience. And the funny thing that's happened is that since the economic meltdown, that's the part of their message that plays the best to people now. People suddenly waking up and understanding that our banking system and our economic system are predicated on this idea of infinite growth, which is just simply not possible on a finite planet, and that we are now hitting the ceiling of that system, and we're going to have to do something very significant to address it. So that's very much a key kind of cornerstone of the Climate Camp message from the very beginning, and it's really nice now that that's the part that they find the easiest message to get out to people.
Well, I think it's kind of funny that we feel like we're stuck with these big banks, and in fact, some of the activists were super glued to the floor of the banks.
Yeah. It's good. Yeah, it's a nice little irony, isn't it?
Can you give us just another favorite story from the film?
I suppose one of my favorite things in the film was an action in which I followed a group of relatively young activists who did the action that you refer to, in which they superglued themselves to the trading floor of the Royal Bank of Scotland headquarters, as well as blockading the front of the building with step ladders and bicycle locks on their necks to the step ladders so that they couldn't be moved. And it was a relatively spiky, as they say, action. You know, this is quite a serious thing to do, and it took a lot of guts to do it. But the average age of the people on the action was probably about 19 or 20. So these were people ranging from 15 years old to, you know, their early 20s. And they allowed me to document their process from the beginning, largely because they wanted to show people that nobody had put them up to this. This was completely their idea. The plan was concocted by them and the whole thing orchestrated by them, and all using consensus, so non-hierarchically, with no leadership structure. And they were very proud of that, and I was very proud watching them do it because they did such an amazingly good job of it. And in the film, it comes about halfway through the film, and I think it's the place where you really begin to see that these kids aren't just talking this is something that they're really living, and that it's really kind of building a completely different way looking forward into the future for them. After all, they are the ones who are going to end up really holding the bag on the issue of climate change into the future. It's their generation that's going to have, you know, be picking up the pieces, and yet at the moment they've got very little political voice. So it was amazing to watch them go out there and demand to have that voice.
I realize it's going to be a little bit difficult to finance and distribute a film like Just Do It. Can you briefly just give us a nutshell of how you met those challenges?
Well, we've engaged in crowdfunding, which is essentially accepting donations on our website, and we are still accepting donations on our website, so we do encourage people to give. At the moment, most of the money that we're trying to raise is to bring the film to America, because it's not cheap to distribute a film, unfortunately. In fact, we've discovered that it's costing us more money to distribute the film than it did to make the film. So, you know, we haven't got massive marketing budgets. We are hoping to get some good American festivals next year, and then we hope to be in the cinema. And then after that, we're going to be doing an extensive process of community screenings. So we'll be encouraging people to put together their own screenings, and we can facilitate that and help that to happen. So it's a kind of tiered level. And then, of course, we'll be doing DVDs and online. And there will be a Creative Commons release of the film. I don't know if your audience is familiar with Creative Commons, but that'll be a free-to-share, peer-to-peer sharing copy of the film. And we are at the moment encouraging all the occupations, all the Occupy, Boston, New York, you know, Wall Street, LA, to show the film, and we've had quite a lot of take-up on that. We've offered it to waive the fee and let them show it for free, because I think those are our people and we want them to see it for sure.
Well, that sounds like a good opportunity to ask you to give us your website.
Yes, it's www.justdoitfilm.com.
JustDoItFilm.com. That's pretty simple. I think we can get that. Well, as we wrap up, Emily, James, the subjects we cover seem so bleak at times that practically nothing is being done to avert a collection of collapses and disasters. Yet you call yourself willfully optimistic. Tell us how you do that.
Well, I'm a bit stubborn, I think, is what it comes down to. Some of us are lucky enough to be optimists, and, you know, some of us suffer being pessimists. I certainly have my pessimistic moments, and you're right, it can be very, very difficult to be realistically looking at and confronting the problems in front of us and knowing how far we are away from a solution, and that can be very hard. But sometimes you just have to decide that you're going to be optimistic, because there's no point in trying if you don't have any optimism left. And certainly that's a kind of attitude that we've employed in many moments on Just Do It and on the production, because there have been a number of times where we could see no way forward and we had no idea how the film was going to get out and get seen. And yet here we are, it's finished. It's been out in the UK in the cinemas and had an amazing response, and we're really looking forward to taking it to the rest of the world. So we don't have the money to do that at all today, and I think that's where the willful optimism comes into play. You know, you make the plans, you decide what it is that you want to achieve, and then you retrofit everything else.
You have been visiting with Emily James, maker of the new film, Just Do It. Find out more at justdoitfilm.com. Emily, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Speaking of actions, a Hawaiian singer named Makana was brave enough to sing his new Occupy Movement song to all the assembled world leaders at the APEC summit in mid-November in Honolulu. While other occupiers protested outside, Makana serenaded the Saturday night diners inside with his song about the people's rage. Find a link to the whole song with lyrics on YouTube in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for caring about your world. I'm Alex Smith. Here is Makana.
Ye come here and gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite. And now